troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Fulta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines. Hey everybody, Kevin and Cameron here with you again. Very excited. Well, I'm excited. Kevin, how excited are you on a scale of 1 to 10?
I'd say 7.
7? Okay. I'll take a 7. Now, what do we got to do to get that up to a 9 to recall my sales days?
Well, I don't know. I think to get more excited from where I am right now would mean maybe to dig through the stories, because they're actually really cool ones this week, and a couple of them kind of related in a funny way. So a lot of interesting things to talk about.
Yes, absolutely. So let's dive right in. So first up, the USDA has relaxed its regulation of biotech crops, but the question has immediately arisen, how is this going to impact food safety? So we're going to dive into that a little bit. Plant-based meat has been enormously popular, especially over the last year, but it appears consumers are overestimating the health benefits of eating these meatless burgers. Next, why are opioids so addictive, and what can we do to reduce addiction and overdose deaths? And finally, Johnson & Johnson has been sued for selling talc-containing baby powder, and so they've pulled it off the shelves in the U.S. over allegations that it causes ovarian cancer. So we're going to dive into these legal claims and see if there's any evidence supporting them. But Kevin, first up, let's get into this story about the USDA. And this, as so many stories we talk about, is right in your alley as an expert. So tell us what's going on here.
Well, it in a way isn't much new. It's an article written by Eric Stokstad for Science. And basically, the idea is that the USDA APHIS, so the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, they wanted to really pull the focus away from the method you use to create a trait and focus on the trait itself. And this all goes back to the idea that years ago, well, not maybe, I don't know, 2017 or so, the Obama administration went down the road of changing the rules from the rather arduous examination of biotech crops as they had in the past to accommodate gene editing, which were very simple changes that were very similar to those or identical to those that you could do with traditional breeding. And so it really started to bring up the question of consistency. If you're not going to regulate traditional breeding, but you would regulate the same change if it was introduced from the lab, then how is that fair? And does that hinder progress? And so that's what they really started to look at.
Now the idea being that the way it's produced, the crop, I mean, that doesn't matter. What ultimately matters is the end product that people are going to consume. And so you need to evaluate the safety of that instead of focusing or hyper-focusing on, say, gene editing or transgenics. Is that the gist of it?
Well, that, but also the potential for invasivity and all the other things that the EPA would normally evaluate. APHIS is some takes a look at those things, like how invasive might it be? How might it compete with other species near the farm if it escapes containment, that kind of thing. But the question comes up is it even necessary? If you change a few bases of DNA with the precise methods of gene editing, so this thing that sometimes we refer to as CRISPR-Cas9 or whatever, you're essentially creating the same kind of genetic switch that you would be making if you did it with traditional breeding. And so the question comes up then, well, why even regulate it at all? And so as a scientist, if you create this kind of product, this kind of crop, you can submit that to the USDA and say, or just a letter saying, here's what we plan to do. Is it exempt from regulation? And USDA will write back within a few weeks or months. It appears that it is or is not a regulated article. And so I actually know quite a few people who got these letters that said, what you're proposing to do, have at it. Who cares?
So obviously, a lot of academic researchers and industry groups, they're really excited about this change. But Science spoke to one researcher, and his name escapes me at the moment. But he basically said, you know, this doesn't go far enough because it's good for the plant that it does apply to, but there's a lot of plants that you could make a similar case for. And I think his example was transferring a gene from, say, a tomato to a pepper, because they're very closely related. So that's still regulated, whereas the plants that you just mentioned, some of the examples, those are okay. So can you speak to that a little bit? Do you think this is still a little overly cautious on the USDA's part?
I think so, too. I think you're referring to Kent Bradford, who they talked to in the article. He's from University of California, Davis. And Kent's been on the front lines of the biotech discussion for a very long time. But the example's a great one. The BS2 gene from pepper confers resistance to Xanthomonas, so a specific bacterial pathogen that causes leaf spot diseases in peppers. But those same types of bacterial diseases occur in a variety of plants, whether it's tomatoes, bananas, a whole bunch. And you can move that pepper gene and solve the problem. Yet this is regulated in the old school transgenic way, which means that you still are stalled for years and years and years because you transferred a gene that we already consume in peppers all the time. So it's not a gene that has any sign of risk or danger, but now somehow becomes a potential risk or danger when you move it to one of these other crops. And that's the logic.
Right. So maybe we'll see something in the future on that front. But I've noticed that the critics of this decision, and some of them are reasonable people, you know, they have some expertise and they're more or less very balanced on the issue of biotech safety. But I've been hearing this criticism that, you know, so many of these crops now are going to go to market without any oversight. And I assume that scares the general public to the extent that they're reading about this. And you mentioned the EPA very briefly, and I just wanted to point out that the FDA can still pull anything off the market if they deem it a risk or if it indeed does start harming people. So I think the idea that there's just, you know, you can just put out willy-nilly whatever you want, I think that's a big exaggeration. So people need to know that. And you already mentioned the oversight from the EPA as well. But add on to that if you have any thoughts.
Well, I think the quote was by willy-nilly, which is one thing. But no, I think the point is that, and this is the point that everybody knows that isn't stated in the article, is that people who are creating new technology in the food space, in order to have the public's trust, we have to ensure that everything is safe. So putting the burden of testing on the companies that are creating the crops and not on the taxpayer and not necessarily on the FDA, which always just provided, you know, USDA, EPA, and FDA, always provided regulatory oversight in a very long and drawn-out, expensive process. In order to streamline it, you still need to have some sort of regulatory testing. Yet, that needs to be up to guarantee that the product is fine and that there's no, you know, collateral effects. And you can determine that in very short time. So changing the model of oversight to just the companies confirming that their products are what their products are and not something else. And that's really good policy.
Sure. And we're going to talk a little later about this Johnson & Johnson lawsuit. And could you imagine if, you know, some big biotech firm released a seed that indeed carried some kind of real danger with it, the lawsuits that they would face would be staggering and it would probably bankrupt them is my guess. And so, you know, the point is they have every incentive, as you just alluded to make sure they're not putting out, you know, dangerous products because the legal environment is just not friendly to, you know, making a mistake like that. So all good points, but let's move on to this story about the exaggerated nutritional benefits of plant-based meat, Kevin. And this is from Jack Bobo, and this is an article that we ran at Genetic Literacy Project.
No, very good. And Jack, you know, Jack always writes a good article, but he really builds on a concept that really was popularized last year when Impossible Burger and Beyond Meats started to really gain market share and attention. And it was the idea that these meat substitutes or plant-based meats were starting to gain more and more interest, and that something like 95% of people have tried this and are not vegetarians. So people just curious, can you get close to meat just with plant goo? And turns out you can. The question is, are they healthier? And they're really not. When you look at them side by side, they're roughly the same in terms of calories and fats and sodium, I think even more sodium, other potential things in there too. And what Jack Bobo really drills down on is, why does this happen? Why do people assume that something is safe because it comes from, in this case, plants? And he talks about this idea of the health halo effect, or health halos. And we've seen this before, the halo effect. When we talk about organic crops, people automatically assume it's safer and better and more wholesome because it has that word in there. And what he really drills down in this article is, why do we have mental shortcuts? And why do we have these ways to make the assumption that something is safe just because that's how it is kind of, maybe not directly marketed, but implied by the marketing?
The point that stuck out to me is that he says we go on mental autopilot. So we will try to like parse out one particular factor. And then based on that factor, we sort of draw a conclusion about whether something is good or bad. So in the context of food, he says, you know, you might see, you know, high protein in a snack bar or something. And you go, oh, well, that's good, you know, but in reality, it's got, you know, 800 calories in it. And so that's not good for you in a snack bar, you know. And so that applies to these plant-based burgers as well. But the other thing that stuck out, and you can comment on this probably more, Kevin, is that it's not really the manufacturers putting out misleading information. If anything, they've had to rebut misleading criticism of their products, but it's still the consumer from, you know, whatever information they've accumulated over the years, misinterpreting what they think they're eating. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's it. It's the consumer's mistake, and that manufacturers don't make any claims. The other example he gives is Subway versus McDonald's. That head to head, a consumer would assume that Subway is healthier. But when you really start to drill down on individual sandwiches, you find that many have higher calorie content, higher sodium content, less healthy fats, whatever, than a burger and fries. And so it's just kind of a strange association. The idea of gluten-free, that many consumers will look at that as a healthy term when really it's irrelevant to them unless they have some sort of a celiac or gluten intolerance. So it's there's a lot of this that is just in the mind of the consumer that makes these mistakes, independent of prodding from the company producing the product. That's really interesting.
Yeah, without a doubt. And one thing I want to mention in passing, and maybe you can add to this too, is that I don't think this is a matter of intelligence or smarts. I mean, maybe education has something to do with it in terms of knowing more about these products, but I think everybody does this. I actually catch myself doing this quite a bit with different things, you know? So if something comes from a brand I trust, for example, and maybe this is slightly different, but I think it's in the same realm where, you know, if it comes from a brand I trust, I go, okay, well, I'm happy with that. Whereas if it's an identical product, but it's from someone I'm not familiar with, I'm a little more skeptical. So, you know, everyone does it. And I think his advice in the article is, you know, you have to slow down and be alert about the messages that are being given to you and what you're consuming. And that's how you can kind of see through this. But this is, I believe he says, this is a natural instinct, this sort of shortcut methodology that we use.
Yeah, I can't remember what he calls it though. Something like description fatigue or dietary fatigue.
Oh, information fatigue, I think, yeah.
Where we get so bogged down in the information that we stop looking. And, you know, my advice is always look at the labels, because if you look at that nutrition label, you'll be amazed at what is in so many products. There was, my old friend Vani Hari, the food babe, she was the one who pointed out, you know, that a pumpkin spice latte has like 46 tablespoons of sugar, which is amazing. Like, how could you possibly put that much in a drink? But the same idea that if you look at the one I look at is ginger beer. Because if you make a Moscow Mule, ginger beer, you know, has ridiculous amount of sugar. And so you look at all of these products that we consume, even salad dressings, barbecue sauce, and you find that inside this relatively innocuous product that you think is associated, you know, with the salad, you know, oh, this is healthy. Turns out you're eating as much sugar as if you sat down with two or three bowls of ice cream. So you have to be on the lookout for it and not just put an automatic halo on the things because of the association they have with potentially healthy diets.
So keep your eyes open and slow down when you're grocery shopping. Maybe that's the important point. But let's talk about drug addiction a little bit, Kevin. And this was actually a video from Mike Davis at TED going over how opioids actually work in your body and how you develop an addiction. So explain this a little bit. I mean, neither of us are experts on this, but you are probably better suited to explain the science involved here.
Well, actually, I really enjoy this topic because it's a very interesting story about what happened. And maybe we'll spend a few minutes on this today, is in that, you know, opium poppies, these are believed by many to be one of the first cultivated crops. Going back even to where you have remains of Neanderthals, you could find evidence that they had cultivated poppies. So we're going way back. And then throughout the Neolithic period, you know, which is another, 10,000 to 4,500 years ago, there's very clear evidence that opium poppies were being cultivated beyond their native range and soon spreading around the world and being used perhaps in rituals. They were buried with bodies in different parts of the world. In Egypt, there was an incredible amount of cultivation, the Sumerians. So this was a crop that had a lot of interest early on, perhaps for its psychoactive effects, for pain relief effects, who knows? But it was certainly used in many contexts. And when you got to the 1800s, we saw the rise of morphine and other opiates. And throughout the 19th and 20th centuries, opium derivatives found central roles in palliative care. So relieving the pain of people who were suffering, possibly from terminal illness, it was a way of kind of providing a pain-free exit in a lot of ways. And I guess it was about 1950 or so that there was the invention of OxyContin. And OxyContin, when it first came out, they realized it had very powerful opioid qualities or morphine-like qualities, but they claimed it was non-addictive, that this was a brand new type of derivative of opium with a very high effect on pain with limited addictive potential. And this kind of thinking of using drugs in pain management, which, you know, the whole field erupted of how do we manage chronic pain or pain associated with the disease. And they started to get doctors on board that here you go, we have pain meds that can solve the problem of pain in patients. And we started to see the emergence of what were called pill mills, these kind of cash-only pain clinics that would prescribe pills without any questions. Or maybe very simple questions, you know, oh, my back's sore. Oh, okay, it's sore. We'll prescribe the pills. And this was very lucrative for these organizations. And then on top of that, you had addicts or people who were using these. I should say they may not have been addicts in the beginning, but people who were users who may have become addicted, who became very good at BSing their way into another prescription. And, you know, all of this has some very personal meaning for me. So I know a little bit about the topic. I had a student who went down this path and started out with injury, with pain medication, graduated to heroin, eventually took her own life because of the hardship of dealing with addiction. So this is something that I've been a little bit familiar with. Patients wanted to live pain-free. You had physicians who were not experts in pain management or addiction, but they were prescribing pills to patients and saying, all right, good, you're on your way. And then on top of that, doctors were being sued because patients were in pain. So there was a CYA element to this too. So you can see all of these avenues kind of creating this perfect storm. And by, you know, the 1990s, 2000s, addiction to opioids was exploding. And in the, 15, 16, 17, there was probably between 50,000 to 100,000 deaths a year from opioid addiction. And currently, even the U.S. consumes the vast majority of the world's opioids, and accidental deaths are, through the roof. And it's getting maybe a little better as of the last year or two, but it turns out that these painkillers, for managing pain, were really just a gateway to higher levels of addiction. And that's what the video that was described in the Genetic Literacy Project showed. Of course, the flip side of this is that many physicians look at this carefully and say the cause-effect relationship isn't really there between prescriptions and overdose death. It's really from heroin and illegally manufactured fentanyl, which comes across the border in buckets, from what I understand. So that's really kind of a setup for the video.
Right, right. And that's a great point that you ended with. And the problem is, and again, not that addiction's okay. People need to be treated, and when people need help, they should get it. But, you have agencies like the DEA who have restricted the manufacture of some of these drugs. And in the case of fentanyl, for example, pharmaceutical companies make it, and they can make it in the proper doses so doctors can administer it. And with the coronavirus pandemic, you have people on ventilators, which from what I've read is a very, very painful experience if you're awake for it. And so they give you fentanyl for pain relief, and sometimes they sedate you, just put you under so you're not awake. And there's legitimate shortages because the manufacturers can't make enough of it. And of course, the streets are flooded with it. But if you're a hospital, you can't buy fentanyl off the street, So you have this situation where you have a drug epidemic, but then you have legitimate uses for small quantities of this stuff, and there are shortages, and so people are suffering. So it's a very difficult problem, but I think there's a whole nother side to the issue that tends to get overlooked because people are so focused on issues of drug addiction.
Well, on top of that, we'll get to this in our next story, Johnson & Johnson is a company that creates opioids, and they're being sued because of their alleged involvement in opioid addiction. And some of the companies, there is evidence, and I don't know about J&J, but evidence that companies were pushing these onto physicians, were pushing physicians to administer them, not talking about their addictive nature, and sending physicians into pain management courses without formal training in pain management and addiction. And so this was also apparently a seed of the problem.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess my issue with it, and again, I'm not an expert, I'm just kind of looking at this from the outside, but my concern is that when you clamp down on it and you just try to restrict access to this, you get the sort of situations, and I don't know your former student's situation, Kevin, but you get a situation where people are addicted to these prescription pills, and then they can't get them, so then they go get fentanyl off the street, or they go get heroin, or, a harder drug, and then they overdose and die, or they get addicted to a street drug for the rest of their life, And so you just end up with tragic situations. And then you have patients that have surgery, or they have a kidney stone they can't pass, or crippling arthritis, major surgery, and they can't get, what should be a legitimate prescription. So it's just difficult. I don't know if there's an obvious solution, but I just think it's a sad situation we're in.
Well, that was kind of the what my student went through. She was not somebody who you would ever guess would be addicted. She was, a beautiful young woman who had all the world in front of her. She came through my lab kind of thinking she was a dumb blonde at first. That was her words. But she really was mentored by the other women in the lab, really learned to do a great job. She was an author on a paper. She ended up going for a master's degree and graduating, and invited me to her master's graduation. And, it was amazing that she did so well and went so far. But after she left here, school, ended up getting in with pain pills, getting on the roller coaster, and again, graduating to the more potent stuff just to satisfy those problems. So, that's, this is a major problem. There's so many folks that are affected, And the tragedy of this is, so on so many levels, is that there's not an easy way out, because it's going to be extremely expensive to treat the people who need the treatment to get out. And that's where this is at. This has got to be something that's treated, managed. You just can't, you know, wave a magic wand. And that's why this is such a problem right now. So about the video. So the video is worth watching because it talks about the mechanism for why this works. And all of us have these opioid receptors in our brains, in our central nervous system, spinal cord, but also in small intestines throughout the entire body. You have lots of opioid receptors, and they're primarily involved in neurotransmission, in emotion, and everything. So they're pituitary gland, skin, analgesic. They have an analgesic function. The idea is that they're sensitive to release of dopamine. And so it's the ideas of like endorphins and runner's highs and all that stuff happens through opiate receptors. The idea is when those are occupied by an opiate, they do a couple different things. And one of them is they suppress noradrenaline. So noradrenaline, you can think of as kind of a gas pedal, where opiates are acting as a brake pedal. The noradrenaline is suppression of noradrenaline is why there's sleepiness, repressed breathing, and those kinds of issues. So keep that in mind. When you suppress noradrenaline, you're suppressing breathing and other major functions. Problem is that when you provide opioids, things like morphine or codeine, whatever, especially the ones that are strong binders, heroin, morphine, they bind the receptor. And when your body doesn't have that receptor active, it makes more receptors, which means in order to get the same effect, you now have to take more drug. So you're taking more drug, then you suppress more receptors. Now you have to have even more receptors made. And this is how the addiction works. You start to, your body compensates for a lack of active receptors and a lack of noradrenaline by creating more and more dopamine or endorphin receptors. I'm sorry, by creating more opiate receptors. Let's just leave it at that. Then eventually what happens is you start to create more noradrenaline receptors so that your body is more receptive to the small amount that it's making. So now you have more sensitivity to the stimulant, more decreased sensitivity to the opioid. And the problem that you have there is that when you come off the opiate, you now have massive amounts of noradrenaline receptors. This is what causes the dependence. And so when you quit, the receptors are staying, the noradrenaline levels go up, and then you have lots of receptors to sense them. So now you get in this hypersensitive state, and this is what usually happens with withdrawal. And it's really awful. This is that, you know, like in the movie Trainspotting, the vomiting and like the really hard withdrawal from this kind of thing. And so this is why, how it works. It really is a balance between these two mechanisms that are acclimating to the presence of the drug and then the thing that is replacing what is missing inside the body. And there's a lot of interesting drugs that go along with this. I mean, I love thinking about this because of all of the interesting inroads. There's some stuff called Narcan is the drug. It's naloxone or naltrexone. These are opiate analogs that are antagonists. So they can take the place of an opioid without causing the stimulation of that system. And so you can take someone who's on opioids, like you know, someone who's on heroin or whatever, you can give them Narcan and instantly displace those receptors. So instantly displace the drug and the drug effect ends almost instantly. So there's some very interesting chemistries that, you know, people who are interested should dig in on this. But this is why the when you look at the problem overall, it's because of very complex chemistry, compensatory chemistry, ways in which the body is trying to fight through being suppressed by the drug. And when you put this in the presence of mental illness or other addictive behaviors, it is really a problem. And this is where, you know, the fixes become so expensive. It's about retraining doctors. It's about giving critical care and counseling and mental health care to the addicts themselves. And really everything that we've looked at in any of the proposed ways to solve the crisis, most experts agree everything just falls far short. So, you know, that's opiate addiction in a nutshell.
Yeah. I think one thing he says in the video is that a lot of these programs, these rehabilitation programs, they actually require you to be detoxed already. And so that's why a lot of addicts die when they're trying to come off this, is because they have to get the drug out of their system. And the only way they can do that is just to not take it. But then you just explain all these reactions in your body. And sometimes, sure. Sometimes it just kills you. You know, it's crazy to think about that.
Well, you can die from withdrawal.
Yeah.
And that's why methadone, Suboxone, all of the, there's one, buprenorphine, buprenorphine. I know, but it sounds like a tool on the Three Stooges. Buprenorphine. Yeah. These are all other drugs that are agonists of, but with less psychoactive effects. And there's a lot to this, and it's a really interesting, deep story. But people are dying from the withdrawal coming off of this stuff, and others are locked onto the alternatives like Suboxone and other therapies for years. So it is a really complicated issue for us to work our way out of.
Yep, yep. Well, hopefully people will pay a little more attention, because you know this goes on whether or not we're interested in it. So if we get more interested, maybe we can change what happens. But let's leave it there. I feel like we could talk about that for probably another 2 hours, but let's not bore people to death. So so this lawsuit, Kevin, or several lawsuits. So the pharmaceutical company Johnson & Johnson is actually pulling its baby powder out of U.S. stores because it's had to pay over $1 billion now in lawsuit damages from people alleging that it causes ovarian cancer. So as I alluded to a second ago, I have a lot to say on this, but what are you thinking about this? And I'm sure we could get into the analog to glyphosate, the lawsuits going on there.
You know, you took the words out of my mouth. This whole mess with talc is extremely parallel to what's happening in glyphosate. And so when you look at, what's going on, as you said, Johnson & Johnson is taking the talcum-based baby powders off the shelf. And they really started to look at this because when you look at what is talc, it is a, silicate. It's mined out of the earth, much like asbestos in those ways. Yet it is very different from asbestos in most of its, in many of its chemical properties. And the problem here is that, okay, you have people who say, okay, it comes out of the earth like talc, or like asbestos. It kind of has properties of asbestos. And we know asbestos is carcinogenic. We know that is a problem. So this might be too. And then they go and look at company correspondence and communication in the company. And when you look at company executives talking to each other, along with lawyers and scientists and others, they had concerns about asbestos being present in talc because these things are mined together. And throughout the 1970s and, until relatively recently, these concerns were discussed. And so all of this put into place fertile ground for attorneys to begin to drum up interest in class action lawsuits. And the argument was that if you applied this to the genital area, that the talc would move through the vagina and into the uterus and into the fallopian tubes and up to the ovaries. In the literature, this is called perineal dusting. And that was always the claim, that the practice of perineal dusting was somehow connected to ovarian cancer.
Now, I don't want to say chastise, but I have to push back on the coverage of this. This NPR story is a good example, but Reuters had a big investigation. The USA Today had another investigation. And my biggest complaint is that they don't actually analyze any of the peer-reviewed data that's now available in 2020. As you mentioned, these internal company documents, which is another similarity with the glyphosate story, they focus on what these company executives were saying 40 years ago. This could be in some of our products, or should we be worried that it's going to go into some of our products? How do we communicate this to the FDA? So it's these kind of open-ended discussions, and they're figuring out what to do. And then meanwhile, you have large studies saying, you know, there's no statistically significant risk. And the most recent study was in the Journal of the American Medical Association. And I think it was just in February of this year, of 2020. And so you have good data more or less dispelling this until new information comes along. And yet you have the mainstream media, mainstream press, reporting these stories as if it's a great scandal. And I think that really does a disservice to the public.
Yeah, well, you know, but the other interesting parallel with glyphosate is most of the data that were suggestive come from rather low-quality case-control studies. So these are studies where people are asked via questionnaire, what products have you used and what diseases do you have? Mm. And they were seeing a very slight association between the use of talcum-based baby powders, again, not Johnson & Johnson, but talc-based baby powders, and ovarian cancers. And it was a very low association. And when you look at the prospective cohort studies, where you actually look at people who are in a study together, going forward together in time of similar background, you saw maybe an effect in some classes of women, in some segments, but probably not. And the problem with this, again, like glyphosate situation with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, is that ovarian cancer is pretty rare. And it's really hard to detect significant differences in these different groups or between people in studies because it's so rare. If you have, you know, five or six, you know, is that a significant difference because it's a, you know, 15% increase? You know, is that real? And that's really what we're looking at here is a very a minor effect on a rare disease.
Yeah, I don't even know what else to say really, except that I'm getting a little frustrated with these sort of like internal documents investigations. And at GLP, we really dove into the Monsanto papers as they're calling them at U.S. Right to Know, and we looked at the internal discussions to see what was being said because the documents come out as part of discovery in these lawsuits. And it's not as scandalous as you're led to believe, you know, but the public generally isn't going to go read 40-year-old memos from a pharmaceutical company because they have lives, you know, and kids to raise, but they trust the media to report that this is dangerous. And that probably recalls movies like Aaron Brockovich or Conspiracy dealing with the tobacco industry covering up the dangers of smoking. And so the narrative is already created and they just sort of backfill with the information they're getting from these news stories. So I wish that would stop. I don't think it will, but you know, who knows?
Well, you're exactly right. All you see in these kind of email course or these correspondences between scientists and company executives is people who speak freely about the concerns they have about something, people being conservative that, you know, we really need to look at this cancer data carefully because it's something that I'm personally concerned about. Okay, well, that's good because you want your product to be safe. You mentioned that you might have concerns. You do more studies that don't show it, but people don't see that. They just see your words of concern. And well, what's really interesting about the baby powder thing here, or the talc powder thing here, is that there have been so many studies done on talc from things like latex gloves to latex condoms to diaphragms, and all of these things that are used in that neighborhood, and you don't see the association. And here you're actually inserting these things into the body in those contexts. And also when you look at other types of, you know, you're talking about ovarian cancer, you're talking about a cancer of the last stop in the female reproductive tract. That when you look at the cervix, at the uterus, there's no evidence of increased cancers from talc. And yet these would be the first stop, especially the cervix. You know, that's its job is to gate the stuff coming in. And so you don't see any associations there. And other times, what's super cool is that when they've actually looked at ovaries, you can find evidence of talc in the ovaries, but in people who never did perineal dusting than in people who are regular perineal dusters. You don't find it at all. So it's really interesting to think about where this could be coming in. And some have proposed that it's coming in through the lungs, that they're inhaling little talc fragments, these little silicate goobers that are ending up in the ovaries. So there's a lot of interesting other correlations that enhance the discussion. But, you know, just to kind of tie this in a bow, the IARC.
Thank you.
They classify perineal use of talc-based body powder as possibly carcinogenic to humans. So even though there's no evidence of it, the IARC is happy to lead you there, which sounds very familiar with something else.
Yeah, well, and it, to figure out why we're laughing at that, it's because IARC has also classified working the night shift and being a hairdresser and drinking hot coffee as carcinogenic. So, you know, there you go. Anyways.
It was what they used in the glyphosate case.
Yeah.
So when you look at this whole case, and here are the parallels. An IARC conclusion of possibly carcinogenic, which then people say, oh, it's a possible carcinogen. Well, all right, let's just say that. Then on top of that, evidence of detection of talc in ovarian tissues, which is where, you know, the site of ovarian cancer, that kind of correlation. Then you have a large company with deep pockets and then some people who are, you know, filing this class action lawsuit. And now all of a sudden you have this perfect storm for a tremendous legal payout. And that really is what this looks like to me. It's using that. And then when you see that same mirrored tactic used in glyphosate around the rare cancer of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, it's amazing the parallels between these two different cases.
Yep. It's almost like it's the same strategy everybody's following. You know, by the way, I think we need to get you a little music intro for your fortune cookie nuggets of wisdom as you end our podcast. So maybe we can work on that this next week.
Well, all right. Well, do I have to have a fortune cookie nugget of dust? What is it?
Wisdom.
Yeah, we'll have to do a musical outro.
Yeah,
for that.
Just like, I don't know, something funky, maybe like a Red Hot Chili Peppers kind of a thing. I don't know. I'll think about it.
Okay. Well, do I have to give one for today?
No, you don't.
Because I can probably come up with one.
Please.
I would say, in the current climate, avoid perineal dusting with glyphosate.
Yep, there you go.
That's kind of the worst of all worlds, right?
Yeah.
No, I think that it's, you know, and that's the sad part. When you start looking across all of today's stories, you find that it's a question of consumer perception. And it doesn't have much to do with the science, whether you're talking about the health halo in Jack Bobo's stories or the class action lawsuits that tend to look at kind of weird surreptitious relationships over hard ones. All of these things together really show where this is, you know, where we are. It's a very interesting question of the way in which science and understanding and perception are oftentimes misused for, you know, for fun and profit, obviously, but also just inadvertently to affect our perceptions. So maybe that's a way to tie them all together.
I consider them very well tied together. Nicely done. So before we go, what's going on Talking Biotech in the next week or so?
Well, the one that was on this last weekend was Vance Crow, who always is wonderful to talk to. He was an employee inside Monsanto who talks about his experiences there and what he's doing now to enhance communication around agricultural sciences. So that's at talkingbiotechpodcast.com. And I can be found at Kevin Fulta anytime on Twitter.
Yep. And Kevin is cool because he'll interact with you if you ask him a question. Not everybody will. So that's always a plus. I am at Cam J English, and you can get this podcast at geneticliteracyproject.org. Subscribe on Spotify and iTunes because we love your subscriptions and your reviews. And if you can, throw us a buck as a donation at the bottom of the article for this podcast. And thank you guys so much. We'll see you next week.